other grandfather on my mother's side was named Frank Lewis.
Okay.
Irby. And of course they took the two together. They put the two together for my
Okay, today is Wednesday, May 2nd. We're here again at the home of Lewis, but you go by
Coach
Les.
Richardson.
Coach Richardson. Here at his home, he and his wife's home here in Madison. This interview is being done for our oral history program at the UW-Madison Archives. And my name is Troy Reeves, and asking most of the questions, and the person I'm going to hand the mic over to right now is Greg Bond. So here you go, Greg.
Thanks. The last time we were here, Coach Richardson, after the tape was turned off, we found out that after your final state championship team in Texas, Jim Brown came down to visit, and football player Jim Brown of the Cleveland Browns came down to visit and talk the team banquet. And I thought that'd be a good place to start to get that on record, if you could talk a little bit about Jim Brown coming to talk to your football team.
Well, Jim Brown was sponsored by, I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Oh, absolutely.
Pepsi-Cola Company. And we were able to get him through he being one of their representatives. And the Chamber of Commerce, that was the, both Chamber of Commerce, the Black Chamber of Commerce and the White Chamber of Commerce, was instrumental in giving us a banquet, not just for minority people, but for the for the entire Waco population. Because according to my records, that was the first championship Waco had, high school had had since 1948, when Waco High, the other school in town, had a champion. It wasn't the first time since Mohawk had a state champion, but it was the first time that the schools, Waco Independent School District, had a state championship team. And it was quite an event. Oh, by the way, they turned the lights off at that banquet before I forget it. And I wonder why they turned the lights off. And when they turned the lights back on, that was a brand new 1966 Fairlane Ford. And that time they called Coach Richardson up and handed him the keys. Thrill of my life. And Jim Brown was the first one to stand up with a standing ovation. And I thought that was kind of unique. By the way, during the time Jim Brown was there, the principal gave me off from school that day. He was an avid golfer. Oh, he loved that. And he set that up in his schedule. And when he, with the prep school coming, he said he wanted to play golf there. And so we arranged to go and play golf that day. And he is, as you know, a tremendous golfer. I think he shot a 72 on a par 72 golf course that first time he ever played it. And it wasn't an easy golf course either. In fact, first time I played on it, it was a country club.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And the first opening statements he made at the banquet was, I had heard that Coach Richardson was a wonderful football coach and also a hell of a golfer. And I wondered how you could be so successful, this is Jim Brown talking, at both, because it takes so much time. And after the third hole, I knew why he was a good football coach. I was shooting that ball all over everywhere. And he made a tremendous speech, and it was, what was so nice about it, it was short. And he talked directly to the players that football wasn't everything. There's another life ahead. And he said, I'm going to retire early from football. I'm going to retire early enough to where I can do something else. And as we all know, he did.
Yep.
And that was the highlight of Jim Brown coming to Waco, Texas. Now that Waco, Texas is famous because of Baylor and basketball team football team.
Yep. So that was 1964.
1964, okay.
Okay, and then so...
65 then.
Oh, 65, okay.
65 Ford, Fairlane 500.
Oh, okay, sure. So then a couple years later, 1966 is when you come to Wisconsin, and we thought it'd be interesting to talk about how that came about. How did you get in contact with them? How did they find out about you? How did you get together with UW Athletics?
Darrell Teddick, one of the assistant football coaches, was in Texas recruiting. And he called me from Houston and asked could he come by and what would be a good time to come by Moore High School. He heard we had some outstanding football players. Ironic enough, he was in the office of the coach in Houston that we had just beaten for the state championship. And he's the one who told him about Les Richardson and outstanding football players we had. Because mm-hmm. Houston always most likely have outstanding football players. But that Coach Patterson is the one who told Darrell Teddick, who was the backfield coach, defensive backfield coach at the University of Wisconsin at that time. And incidentally, Milt Broom had also told him before he left going on a recruiting trip, be sure and drop by Waco, Texas. I understand they got some good football players down there. Because most of the time they come to Texas, they kind of bypass us. Mm-hmm. Other than UCLA and Arizona State and teams in that vicinity, they would come by. And of course, Baylor University, I think they were pretending mm-hmm. that they wanted to recruit some of my players because they never did.
You know, 65 was still a little early for a lot of Southern colleges to be recruiting black players.
That's right.
So then they came to talk to you and talk about your players. How did it turn out that they were interested in you as a coach?
He looked at the film. We were filming our games at that time, mm-hmm. and Darrell Teddick did the coach, and he recognized some players. And of course, Parade magazine had made my son an All-American at that time. I think it was that time, yeah. And of course, he looked at him and he recommended when he got back to Coach Broom that we try to recruit two of our football players. Split end named James Jones and Lewis Richardson. And of course, the two of them came up here that summer. But that's how they discovered. And that was part of the reason. Now, at first, my son had not made up his mind where he was going to go to school. And as I said before, I wanted him to go to UCLA. Mm-hmm. And shortly after Darrell Teddick got back, I guess that was part of their strategy because it wasn't on my mind. Ivan Williamson called me.
The athletic director.
Athletic director. And asked me if I was interested in coming to Wisconsin. I said, well, I don't know. I hadn't ever thought about it. Let me think it over. Then after a day passed by, Milt Broom called me and asked me if I wanted to be on his staff. And I said, well, what would I be coaching? He said, you'd be coaching the receivers. I thought that was interesting because I played in myself when I was in school. And one thing led to another. And it boiled down to, I made the decision, talked it over with my wife, and I talked it over with my college coach, Fred T. Pops Long, as I've said before. And of course, he was a Michigan guy. And he said, you mean you got an offer to go to the Big Ten? And you thinking about it? There's nothing to think about. You go. And that was the final worried I had with anybody else other than my family. I was coming to Wisconsin as an assistant football coach.
So, what if you could talk a little bit about?
May I say this?
Oh, great. Sure. Go ahead.
After I had made that decision, of course, it came out of the papers and so forth. Then a Chicago group called me in Texas and say, "You don't want to come up here because the coaching staff is going to be shaken up. They're going to stop in the middle of the broom. He's going to be terminated." I said, "What? Now, if you want to come up here and just coach a year and then go back to Texas, you better get you some better security." I said, "Uh-oh." But I had made the decision that I was coming. And as we all know, on a Sunday or Monday or whenever the Rose Bowl game is on, you always envision being on the sideline as a coach at the Rose Bowl. Oh, boy. And especially after University of Wisconsin played that time ran out on them, they say. Mm-hmm. And Patrick Richter days and Vander Keller.
Yep.
Especially after seeing that game. So I could envision my son being the quarterback, me being on the sideline, because we had grown up looking at the Rose Bowl. That was the granddaddy of them all, as you know. And my wife would prepare for it. She would cook, if it's a Sunday, on a Sunday, she would cook enough food for that. For when we got back from church. We got the TV trays out because we knew this was going to be the afternoon looking at the bowl games. Mm-hmm. So that was the history behind me coming to the University of Wisconsin. And as I said, the Chicago group turned out to be right. After the first year, Bill Brewer was terminated by Chancellor Ed Young. But in the meantime, though, when that Chicago group called me, it got me to thinking. So I called the president of the university, and I told him the situation. He said, "Well, I'll tell you what, Coach Richardson, Fred Harry Harrington, I don't know if you're around
mm-hmm,
then.
Absolutely.
That was a long time ago. He said, "What kind of assurance can we give you?" I said, "Employment." if I uproot my family and bring them up there, I don't want to stay up there in 1 year. That'd be too embarrassing to come back after 1 year. But in the meantime, though, I had gone to the superintendent and told him, too, about a leave of absence. And so he said, "Well, we don't, public school doesn't grant leave of absence, but I assure you, though, we won't have any problem finding you a job in the public school system." And so he gave me, the president sent me a telegram. At that time, they didn't have all these other fancy means of communicating. He sent me a telegram, and in that he said, "Guarantee a 5-year deal." And thank the Lord, that's what saved me.
Well, you read my mind. That's the exact question I was going to ask about the 5-year contract you signed when you came here. So how about, and then we talked a little bit last time.
And later on, when the other coaches got fired and found it out, God, don't they always pissed off at me. Excuse me. I said, "Well, that can't happen because I was smart enough to get
some right.
securities."
So we talked a little bit last time about your son also came to University of Wisconsin. I thought we'd talk a little bit about that again, how it turned out that you both ended up here.
Well, you know what the rumor is.
That it was a package deal.
Yeah, that they signed me first. They may have had that in mind, I don't know. But I do know I was a football coach, and I had championships to prove it.
Oh, absolutely.
And at that time, it wasn't no guarantee that he was coming. Until he and his mother got together. I refuse to believe this day, although their intentions were may have been. Well, what's wrong with it? If I get a chance to coach in the Big Ten, so I don't think either. If that was their intention, it was a negative thing. I thought it was a positive thing.
they got both their men.
Because at that time, you know as well as I do, there were no black. They had a coach at Iowa, mm-hmm. Gillum, I believe his name
yep.
was. But he was a bona fide faculty member like I was. I had to go to the bursar's office or wherever it is and sign papers and so forth and have some faculty status or something because I wasn't just a person to come in and coach and go home. I was here 24/7 here.
Sure.
I'm always interested in the route you take to get here, not necessarily obviously the mile by mile, but is there anything that's memorable about packing up and moving from Waco to Madison?
Well, first I didn't want to drive two cars up here, but my brother decided he would come with us. So we had to drive two cars up here. But the moving van, Reynolds moving van, I believe it was, said they would put the car in the van and bring it. Well, I thought about it. But after my brother decided he wanted to come, he wanted to bring his son too. And then my mother-in-law decided she was going to come. My wife's mother, and so we had a number of people to drive up here. And of course, my mother was living in California at that time, so she met us here. She came here the day after we got here. The route was through Oklahoma. We spent the night in Oklahoma. It was the first night we spent with friends. We had friends all the way up, and then the next time was in, I believe it was St. Louis we spent the night. And then we drove all the way into because they wasn't too receptive to in the restaurants and hotels at that time for people of color. So we had to stay with friends and do the driving the rest of the way. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
So the family moved up here, I think, in June, you said, last time, and you came up here a little earlier to actually live in Camp Randall with some of the other assistant coaches. That would be interesting if you talk about sort of your first trips up here to meet the assistant coaches, live in Camp Randall, sort of your introduction to UW and the UW Athletic Department.
It was lonesome because I'm used to being around the family mm-hmm. and standing at Camp Randall Stadium. Was miserable, but I had to endure it. And one of the other assistant coaches was in there with me too. He had to, he left his family, and I was fortunate that an automobile salesman—I can't think of his name—he provided me with a car. And I was able to have my own transportation. The other coaches, they would use UW cars, mm-hmm. but they'd also have to go recruit or something to justify using them. And of course, they didn't go recruit all the time. But the coaches that stayed with me in the Camp Randall. Roger Freach, he used that my car as much as I did. And one time, to tell you the truth, he slipped off from me and drove all the way back to Memphis, Tennessee, and I didn't know where he was. He got lonesome for his family. Anyway, that was how I survived. And I had a good friend up here, who had married a student that I taught back in Moore High School, and they lived right around the corner from Cameron Stadium, and they invited me over all the time. Invited me over all the time. And his wife, Ernestine Sapp, would cook. Because there wasn't no training tables, nothing like that open. You got to fend for yourself. And I spent quite a great deal with them. And that took out some of the loneliness.
And what was your friend's name?
Walter Sapp. He got his PhD here at the University of Wisconsin. And he later left and went to Tuskegee Institute, you know, right, George Washington College School. And he and his family packed up. Spaghetti and meatballs she fixed. Oh, and it was good. But she was fixing because she was stretching for her family, see? Because they were living off his scholarship. But now she's an attorney, Dr. Ernestine Sapp. And on the board of trustees at my college, Wiley College. She is, yeah.
Were they the only people you knew in town when you got here?
The only other person I knew was Marshall Colston. And Marshall Colston was a big civil rights advocate. Mm-hmm.
He was, I believe, the president of the Madison chapter of the NAACP at that time?
At that time, you're right, yeah. You did your research, yeah. And now I...
How did you know him?
He was on the welcoming committee. In fact, he called me while I was still in Waco. He said, now, when you come up here, I'll meet you and greet you, and you can make my home your headquarters. And that was another relief I got. But he had to come by there and pick me up. But anyway, from Cameron State, and I didn't want to burden him like that too often. But that was some relief, because his wife would fix dinner too. Yeah. And by me affiliating with him, the newspaper got a hold of it, that I think I attended one meeting. I can't think of his name right now, but I'll think of it later on. Took Marshall Coase's place on the NAACP after he retired. After he left the NAACP. And I went to one meeting. And it was about 10 or 15 people there. And the only one that they picked out the next day in the newspaper was Les Richards. Attended the NAACP meeting where they were going to advocate some kind of strike or something. I don't even know what they were talking about. But I was just there trying to show support anyway. At that time, I needed support too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sort of a good transition here. Just maybe talk a little bit about the change from Waco, Texas to Madison, Wisconsin. I'm sure that's a big change geographically, culturally, weather-wise. Just any memories about making that shift from Texas to Wisconsin?
They told me it was going to snow, but they didn't tell me. And the first, you know, little light snow flurries come. Mm-hmm. My family and I was out there sweeping the snow. And then we said, oh, this is not bad at all. This is a piece of cake. And lo and behold, when it did start snowing, and then we wondered, what did we get ourselves into? And to this day, my wife and I, every winter, we're going to move back to Texas. And then when the summer come, of course, best place in the world to be. Mm-hmm. And we did that for, I guess, what, 40 years. Yeah. Saying we're going to move back to Texas. That was the highlight of my coming to Wisconsin. And coaching the football, they warned me, say it's going to get cold, and it's going to, we have to turn the lights on to practice, and all of the above happened. And I put on everything they had in the locker, in the coach's dressing room, from long johns to hoods to everything. Long johns and then the sweatpants and it was miserable. But once you got out there and started moving around, you could do it. And I did for 4 years. But that was the biggest surprise. Although they warned me, that was the weather.
Speaking of football, what was it like making the transition from coaching high school to coaching college? Was that a big transition? Was it relatively easy for you? I'm interested in hearing about that a little bit.
The only thing that complicated me, because coaching football is football.
Sure.
Fundamentals are blocking and tackling.
And conditioning.
And, well, sometimes other teams don't condition as much as I condition. Mm-hmm. But it's the same. Blocking and tackling and fundamentals of football is the same. Now, different levels have different strategies. For example, the University of Wisconsin had different formations, and that's what really fouled me up. Different formations for every game. I never heard of that before, that you go in and change your entire approach to the game by looking at the film of what somebody else did and had some success, and you would insert that into your offense and defense as the way we should play. Hell, I know those kids didn't know all those plays because I didn't know them all. Change your entire offense and defense. They didn't change the defense as much as we changed the offense. And that was the most complicated portion of football. And by the way, our offensive coordinator, who came here from Arizona, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Only wanted to be the offensive coordinator, quote, because if he ever was interviewed for a head coaching job, they mostly hire offensive coordinators rather than defensive coordinators. And that was his only reason, rationale. Never coached offense in his life. Anyway, they would change offenses complete, overhaul the offense. Now, most coaches would add a few plays to surprise the other team or something like that. But you don't change your whole basic offense and numbering system for every game. That's ludicrous. And other than that, that was the only thing that really bothered me. And it was only a big change that I do it. In high school even, I would change some plays because our other team had looked at my film.
Sure.
And so they were ready for the basic thing, but not everything. You don't change the entire offense, no.
So wondering about after you got here, what it was like working in the athletic department with your relationship with the other coaches, with the athletic director, with other people in the athletic department. Was that also a smooth transition for you? You were welcomed?
The athletic director was fine. He invited me out to his home, me and my wife, and their wives were fine. And Mill Broom's wife was in the hospital, and he invited me out. And going on trips, Milt Broom would introduce me to Woody Hayes. In fact, I went to Woody Hayes' house, and we had brunch or whatever you call it. And the name of the coach at Michigan?
Bo Schembechler.
Bo Schembechler, yeah. And who's the one before him, though?
Anyway. Fritz Kreisler is before that, I believe. I don't know who was before Schembechler.
But anyway, he invited me to their home. And that first year was what I expected in the, as a coach in the Big Ten, when Milton was head coach. Mm-hmm. But don't ask me about what happened after that. But you will.
I want to ask one thing before that.
Sure.
Before we ask about that, and this may lead to that, you always talked about how your teams were the best conditioned. Was that something, as an assistant coach, that you were able to have your athletes do, or were you sort of underneath the head coach, were you part of their conditioning system?
The head coach was in charge of the conditioning. I had no say. Other than the staff meeting. And they fall on deaf ears.
So in your mind, they weren't being conditioned as much as you?
No, I didn't see that. They didn't lose because of conditioning. We lost because of, maybe we weren't quite as prepared as the other team.
So, you may or may not want to talk about this based on previous statements, but after your first year in Madison, Milburn was let go, and they hired John Cota, I think they pronounce his name. What was it like working for him?
Well, working for him was okay. It was just the surrounding staff that he brought in. Now, not all of them.
Sure.
But there was a group called... when their playing days, it was called the Hard Rocks. I don't know if you...
Yeah,
the
early 50s, the right. UW defense.
Yeah. And he hired some of those people, but they were also dear friends and buddies, and they used to, party and go out together. And they didn't have, in my opinion, the necessary discipline, relationship, that assistant coaches should have with a head coach. Mm-hmm. It was hard to separate that buddy-buddy and friend stuff. Let me give you an example. In staff meeting, we would talk about one procedure and one offense and one defense and one strategy. And if one of the coaches, Hard Rock buddies, didn't like it or disagreed with it, the next day, after we'd all agreed now, the staff meetings, the offensive staff, particularly where I was with a long time, the next day it was all changed. And we'd be looking at each other, what happened? And I live on the west side of town. And two of the other coaches live on the west side of town, too. One of the Hard Rocks live on this side of town. And I would see this coach's car, at the head coach's, I have to pass right by the head coach's house every time I come home. Mm-hmm. See, he lived up there on Odana, who, in his father-in-law's house, the mayor, Reynolds at the time, ex-mayor, Reynolds was the mayor when I came here. And, of course, Cota was married to his daughter, the head coach. And I would see that car parked there. And then I knew why everything was changed the next day. And that was a mystery, not only to me, but all of the others, too.
Before moving on to other things, any memories of... interesting games, important practices, just any like coaching memories of your, I guess, throughout your 4 years coaching for UW, anything that stands out from the, from your coaching career?
Well, one particular thing, in one particular practice, well, several of them, but I'll just mention one. One of the assistant coaches fell and missed a block, or he didn't put the necessary effort he thought should have been put in receiving a pass or something. Mm-hmm. The assistant coaches went nuts. Oh, he raved and raved. And the language he was using was so explicit. And he was trying to encourage other coaches, including myself, get on his butt, get on him, get on him. He didn't make an effort to catch the pass. The pass was two yards behind him. He should have made an effort, but he couldn't have caught this ball if he had a basket, a net, because it was too far behind him. Instead of getting on the man that threw the ball, he would get on the receiver. Of course, I was coaching the receiver. And he raved and raved and raved and raved. Oh. And at that time, the head coach had to step in. Because you don't do that type of thing, especially in front of the players. And much less embarrass another coach, in particular myself, yeah. But there was some other incidents I just won't mention at this time.
Okay. Maybe I'm changed to the subject a little bit. Madison, the late 60s, a lot of student unrest, a lot of interesting things going around on campus. We always like to ask people who are here, any memories of like the 60s in Madison, the protests, the riots, the tear gas on Baskin Hill, stuff like that. Were you aware of that kind of stuff? What are your memories of that, of those topics?
That was turmoil. The some of the football players were down there. Why, I don't know, but A student who was a good friend of the black athletes, I think he was the one who carried them down there. And so the white athletes didn't quite like that. So they were down there too for some reason. And then they crossed paths and got into some kind of physical brawl. Not the players, but the guy that carried them down there. Mm-hmm. He jumped on one of our football players. And that wasn't necessary. But anyway, I remember that during the 60s. And of course, I don't know how this intertwined, but that carried over until the football players. Not liking the way they were being treated. And of course, during that time, too, you notice other schools was having athletic problems, too. Mm-hmm. Even Michigan State. And of course, some of those players were boycotting and they were doing different things. And of course, you know, we don't recruit no dummies up here at the University of Wisconsin. You can't get in school. And so those the football players, they knew something was going on and it wasn't quite right. And there's the time, you remember they had a session with white players going to the athletic committee? Well, after the black players went first, mm-hmm. Then the white players were interviewed too. And of course, that carried over into the coaches and meeting and so forth. Those are terrible times. That's about all I can say about that. Mm-hmm.
Do you think the black players had their grievances were accurate? They complained about sort of a bad relationship between some of the coaches, but then also things that transcended race. They were concerned about tutoring for the athletes. They were especially concerned about players being allowed to stay in school once their scholarships are up for that fifth year to graduate. Did you think their concerns were appropriate?
Absolutely. If you be more specific, I can tell you something. Do you have a specific thing you have in mind?
I'm interested in 1968. There's the story goes, the last game of the year at home against Minnesota, the black players threatened to boycott the game and not play in it. And according to the articles I've read, when the coaches left the locker room, they weren't sure what was going to happen, and then all the players agreed to play in the game. Does that sound right to you?
They threatened because their complaints or grievances weren't being met. They were being completely ignored because the coaches even said, there are no problems here. But yet there were problems, and they couldn't see it. And, of course, you know, we had a psychologist and a psychiatrist to talk to the coaches and tell them, and one of these was a black, the psychiatrist was black. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know this, the psychiatrist is the one who has a PhD in both, right?
I don't know.
Psychology and medicine.
Mm, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was the black ones. And he was trying to tell the coaches the attitude of the coaches was not enhancing the black athletes to play, but it deteriorated them from playing. It wasn't motivating them to play.
Mm-hmm.
You can't play any or do anything worthwhile if you're angry. It's somebody.
Sure.
And, of course, the coaches disagreed. Thought the more you ride them and get on them and criticize them and chew them out, the better they're going to perform. Mm-hmm. Hey, it's all right if you're winning. That'll work sometime if you're winning. And we were, close to 20-something games almost, and we were losing season after season.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to be a 5-meter Cowboy to figure that out.
Sure.
Change your methods.
And then if we can stick in this subject for a little bit longer, I think in 1968 the black players boycotted the team banquet to make their grievances better known. Was that, I assume that was rather controversial?
Not all of them boycotted.
Okay,
about
some of them.
7 or 8 of them attended. But they were still trying to get attention to what we are concerned about.
Sure.
And it was still being ignored until this black psychologist came in, and they began, some of the coaches, I don't want to say all of them, two of them never even attended the sessions, but they began to, but the head coach was in favor of it, because he too, he knew his job was in there.
Of course.
Because we were losing. We were losing. And this person was trying to help us and wasn't charging anything and spent day and night trying to help us recognize what we were doing wrong and encourage us what we were doing right, eating with the players. Usually we go in, coaches sit on one table and eat. That's what most people do, but in this instance you couldn't do that. You ought to sit down and eat with your players sometime. The players you're coaching. In other words.
Makes sense.
Don't isolate yourself.
Sure.
Only as when you're dogging them and kicking them around on the field. let them know you have their best interest at heart, mm-hmm. including graduation. Yeah.
So this turmoil, it seems, may have translated to the coaching staff a little bit. Some of the coaches recognize there's a problem and some might not have.
Oh, shoot. In staff meetings, being the only minority black person in the room, it was difficult for me to even say anything because it may be interpreted the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And please believe me, that was a boogaboo. And you don't have any peers,
sure,
that you can bounce someone off of in the meeting or after the meeting. It
put you in a tough spot.
Oh, turmoil. The most embarrassing situation was when I was accused of instigating, more or less, the black players' route, boycotting it, I can say. In fact, I was the one who kept them from encouraging them to stay up all night to make them play in that Minnesota game. Mm-hmm. All night at the dormitory. And who they were accusing of being the leaders were not the real leaders. The real leaders was a person now that has his attorney's degree. He's an attorney mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C. And that was a spokesman that went before the athletic mm-hmm. board, too. Mayor Redding, you probably already know his name. And he was the one that was smart enough. And when he presented the grievances to the head coach, and still the head coach thanked him, they denied it, and that's the worst thing you can do is be in mm-hmm. denial.
Sure.
And that's what led to the potential boycott. In fact, I stay up all night again. The black players were going to do like the Michigan State player. They were going to all go down to the practice field by the natatorium. They were going to go down there and practice. They're going to get dressed and go down there and practice, away from campground, mm-hmm. where the rest of the team was practicing. And to show you how smart they were, they didn't invite me to come down. Because this peer thing was supposed to be between coaches, it's supposed to have a good relationship, mm-hmm. which we did not have, but supposed to. And they were smart enough not to invite me down. And they said, you could come if you want to. But that did not stay up all night again, preventing that from happening. Because mm-hmm. newspaper people, they look for yep. controversies. And interpret that different from what the black people are trying to get some attention mm-hmm. to look at our concerns here. Pay attention to it. Fall on deaf ears.
I'm curious if you remember what kind of things you said to the players in these late night meetings when you're encouraging them to play in the Minnesota game, encouraging them not to practice on their own. Do you remember the types of the arguments you made to them to try to keep them from doing these things?
You can't do this. You're not punishing the coaches. You're punishing the University of Wisconsin where you got your scholarship. You know, you're here to get an education first. And as I say, the players are intelligent enough to say, yeah, we are here to get an education. I said, you're not here to be making the pros. If you make the pros, fine, but if you can't depend on that either. You're here to get an education from one of the greatest universities, and we all know that University of Wisconsin is what you get a mm-hmm. degree from here. I won't say you got it made, but you're in a position to have it made.
Sure.
And I said, that's what you're here for? And what do your parents tell you when they call you? They don't ask you about the football, I bet you. without asking you about your education. How you doing in school? And I know black parents, they do. That's what they ask. They'll ask about what was the school or who won the game or something like that, but they're going to ask you about your education before they hang up that phone. And, of course, that rang a bell with the coaches, with the players. I said, you can't jeopardize your scholarship and these things because of a group that's not treating you fairly now. I said, you know, that's life sometimes. But I knew it wasn't right, but I knew they couldn't afford to do that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in the best interest, not only the team, but their personal lives. Mm-hmm. And they bought into it. But it took a while. I think I took them out to eat after that, too. I was talking to the leaders who were going to call the boycott. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think the athletic department finally started to address some of these problems, some of these grievances the black players had?
The athletic board did. I don't think the coaching staff ever.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what types of things the athletic board did or suggested that teams, coaches should do?
Well, that was closed session, you know.
Oh.
But they did recognize.
Mm-hmm. Which is an important first step.
Yeah, they concerned. And that's what the black athlete was asking.
Yep.
Recognize that we have a concern that ought to be addressed. And that's what led to the, I believe, to the Dr. Mosby fully getting involved. Not only with the players, but the coaching staff.
Is where, this the where psychologist?
Most of the problems, yeah, right. Okay. Where most of it stemmed from, yeah.
You mentioned it was hard not having any peers in the coaching room when these problems were going on. And one thing I'm very interested in hearing about is that the 1970 American Football Coach Association, you helped organize the first meeting of black coaches at predominantly white institutions. And I was wondering if you could talk about how that came about and if you have any memories from that meeting or those conversations you're having with some of your peers at other institutions.
I was interested in if they were having the same problems I was having. And what were they doing to compensate? Mm-hmm. And I remember, I can't think of that young man's name. It was University of Washington. He and I both kind of called that group together. And I think another person from Associated Press, Green, Bob Green, anybody know him?
Not sure.
I think he was stationed in Milwaukee at the time.
Oh, okay.
Bob Green. He attended the meeting also, and that's why they had got in the newspaper. We were trying to exchange information. We were trying to have somebody we could communicate with.
Sure.
They were on our level and catch the same hell we were catching. But I don't think any of them, I don't think it was but two or three of them there. I don't think any of them had the same harsh complaints that I did. With the fellow coaches, you see. That's where after Milt Broom days, my coaching was hell. I'd be late to meetings because I didn't want to go because I knew it wasn't going to be right. In fact, my most memorable memory is on the Arizona trip to Arizona. I tried to miss the plane that was going there because if you say you're going to leave at a certain time, you all leave at a certain time. And that was waiting around for me. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I got a call, and I was being late. I said, oh, I overslept now. Well, we're waiting on you. I said, I didn't want to hold up the players because a lot of sports writers and other folk was going on the trips too. And the reason, my rationale for not wanting to go, during all that week, they had promised our starting quarterback that he seemed to be more effective. And when he was young, I think he was only a sophomore. And he was more effective coming in after off the bench than he was if he started the game. And we had a senior quarterback that played some games ahead of him his sophomore year. And that's where they discovered he was effective. So they devised a scheme when we go to Arizona State, and you know Arizona State has the fastest players in any conference. And, of course, one of our coaches came from Arizona State. And the rumor was, and it got in the paper, and it got on their bulletin board, so you don't have to put the coaches put the thing on the bulletin board to fire up his team. One of our coaches said they can't read and they can't write. And so they had that on the board. And when we got there, and I think the school got to be 37 to zero, they said, we can't read, we can't write, but we can sure run. And they were making 30 and 40-yard touchdowns on the runoff lead that everybody we had. So they had planned on, back to the original, planned on starting Lewis, my son, as the quarterback. And he was going to sprint out and run and throw. They only gave him three plays because they were going to bring in the other starter who was most effective, after the after he come in, because the senior quarterback now was on the scout team. He was no longer part of the varsity at all. In fact, that was a starting quarterback. They relegated him to scout team. In fact, I coached him. He was throwing to my receivers. But anyway, they were going to start him first quarter, few minutes, and then they were going to, after preparing him all week, and announced him as a starter and so forth, they were going to pull him after 2 or 3 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes, or 2 or 3 series. And, of course, being a coach and a dad, that was hard to take. That was hard to take. Because I knew what was going to happen. And I didn't want to see it. I don't want to be a witness to that thing. Oh, damn. Oh, y'all don't know. And you couldn't do nothing about it. Mm-hmm. Not a thing. And you didn't even have anybody to talk to or come to your aid and express how wrong that was, because others agreed.
It sounds like a very difficult situation for everyone.
Well, I don't know if it was difficult for them, because they the one who concocted that. But it was difficult for anybody like yourself or me, or any human being, I put it that way.
So, I'm curious if at this meeting in 1970 of your colleagues at other schools, if you were getting together to sort of exchange ideas, do you remember if anyone had any particularly good ideas or things they were doing at their school that you thought was working well, if you remember?
was the coach's name at Iowa?
Is that the one you mentioned earlier?
Right.
Gillum?
Gillum, yeah. Gillum said, man, let me tell you something. Can't fight City Hall. You just can't fight City Hall. And, of course, he's met the rest of the coaching staff. Because they're going to do what they're going to do. He said, and I agree. Because when I took the job up here, I knew it wasn't going to be peaches and cake. But, of course, I didn't expect it to be this horrible either. Mm-hmm. But somebody had to do it.
Sure.
Some of us had to do it in order to make it better for the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, I endured it. And now, of course, you can look at the coaching staff all over the country, even at the University of Wisconsin. Not only do they have one black coach, they got several black coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say I was responsible for that, but somebody down the line realized how important it was to recruit black players and play black players and have some positive result. Somewhere down the line, did y'all ever see the coaching staff? Before I got here,
so we're looking at sort of a doc, looks like a almost like a yearbook for the athletic department. And we're looking at the Wisconsin coaching staff from...
Is that the...
Says they won Big Ten titles in 59 and 62, so it's... Might be six. There's something down here that there's a winner in 65, so it might be the year of 65. But yeah, so looks like it's probably the year before you got here. And of course, the coaching staff is all white.
Are the players in there too?
This one doesn't look like the players are in it. It looks like it's all coaches and others.
Others. You see the athletic, Wisconsin athletic staff?
In this one? Oh, okay.
Is it in that one?
No, that wasn't in there.
No. So this is a Wisconsin athletic staff. It's a similar type. Matter of fact, it has the same cover.
I know.
All right. Yep.
I couldn't even go to anybody.
Right. Those folks are all white, too.
As old as it's there. Of course, I knew this before I came up here. I didn't know this before I came up here, but I found out after I got here.
Coach Richardson, we're over an hour now. We're about an hour and 5 minutes. I know you're sort of flipping through these documents here. Is there anything else you want to say about your time specifically as a coach? And then maybe what we'll do is we'll start next time, if you allow us to come one more time, we'll start next time with your move to administration.
Okay.
So is there anything else that comes to your mind that you want to talk about as your time about your time here at UW as a football coach?
It was no fault of the university. I admire the university for living up to the contract they provided me. And but coaching at the University of Wisconsin was nothing like I envisioned. In fact, I liked coaching. I did. Until I coached at the University of Wisconsin. I never envisioned. After Milt Broome days, I'll make sure to say that. I never envisioned the humiliation and non-comradeship I endured as an assistant football coach. It was the most miserable days of my entire life. I never experienced anything that somewhat demeaning. An unprofessional attitude. I didn't do it as a football coach at the University of Wisconsin. Sorry, my voice is fading out, but it's difficult for me to say.
Totally understand.
But it's the truth. But as I said before, somebody had to do it.
Absolutely.
And I don't regret doing it because of the results that I see today.
But you also had some good relationship with many of the players in the team, though, I believe.
Some of the best were the seniors. Bill Fritz and John Teetson, and especially Eric Rice to this day, were some of the best coachable. In fact, I had difficulty pronouncing some of the names sometimes. And then some of those players, at that time they were all white, that I'm talking about now, would come to me in a meeting. We had a player, you meet with your players, and they were very helpful and helped me pronounce names even. Because John Teets, I would call him Tits. I shouldn't say that. Anyway, those seniors, and some of them even call me to this day when they come to town. Coach Richardson, how you doing? Okay. We wonder why are you still here. But anyway, and the the quarterback who was is the nicest gentleman ever been around. In fact, during my travel after coaching days, and he had graduated from school, he was on an airplane, and we both happened to be going the same direction. And he had first class seat. And lo and behold, he came back and invited me up to sit in the first class. And that was our starting quarterback.
So it sounds like going back to your days, high school coaching, college coaching, a lot of players still keep in touch with you.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Back in high school, we still have what we call a Mohair reunion, the name of my school. And when I walk in the door, I'm embraced from the time I get there until the time I leave. And those were the good old days. And that's when coaching was fun.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of my assistant coaches, when they integrated the schools in Waco the year after I left, he said, "You know what? I found out coaching was hell. But the coaching was fun at Moore High School when Rich was the head coach." They called me Rich. Yeah. He said, "It was fun then." I said, "Sure, it was fun. We were winning."
That doesn't make it easier.
Yeah.
I think this is a good place to stop, and if you'll allow us another interview, we'd love to talk about your move to Bascom Hill and administration, where you worked until the 80s, I believe, on Bascom Hill.
Okay.
All right, so this concludes the second interview with Coach Richardson. Thank you very much, Coach.
All right. Thanks a lot.